on the notes is covered from number 15 to 18 is the notion of higher viewpoints. And then from 19 down to 19 and 20 on inverse insight, and then the rest of it on empirical residue. So those are the three other notions that I'd like to cover today: higher viewpoints, inverse insight, empirical residue, the last three sections of the chapter. Higher viewpoints. First of all, we'll take what he says, and then I have an example of one from Lonergan's own work, I think, which is a function as a higher viewpoint. Insight develops, and the development may take the form either of a homogeneous expansion or of a higher viewpoint. In mathematics, as long as you move from addition to subtraction to multiplication to division, you're into a homogeneous expansion, because there's no change in the basic notion. In a homogeneous change, no change in a homogeneous expansion, no change is involved in the notions and operations that you've already employed. Once you've learned subtraction, you don't change anything about addition. Once you've learned multiplication, you don't change what you already know about addition and subtraction. So the movement then from addition and subtraction to multiplication and division to powers and roots does not involve any change in the notions and operations of addition and subtraction. In a higher viewpoint, there is such a change. For example, there's a new set of rules governing even addition and subtraction when you push those operations fully and you get into negative numbers and so on and so forth. Then you're actually, you are making a shift, you're expanding, and you're expanding in a way that involves a fundamental shift in the meaning of the terms. In Lonergan's own development, there's a number of things, and there's a very serious question as to when in his development he's actually reached a higher viewpoint where there's actually a shift in the fundamental terms and relations at any certain point, and where it's a homogeneous expansion. But when I had the privilege of being present when he first delivered first made public, the insight into functional specialization as structuring the entire discipline of theology. And I think that first of all, the impact on all of us was amazed. It was an incredible experience that anyone could pull together an entire discipline the way he did. We were wondering, what's he going to do with theology? And the way in which presented something where actually everything that theologians do is related to everything else that theologians do, all in terms of something else that he had started to work out in this book. But if you've got experience, understanding, judgment, and decision, and then you put them into two phases of the discipline, and you've got research, interpretation, history, and dialectic, and then that's going up. And then you've got a process that goes this way. And you've got foundations, doctrines, systematics, and communications. And I think it's the basic movement towards what might be a higher viewpoint is when you begin to say that it's not just going up, it's also coming down. And as you come down, there is some kind of, at least the movements are, there's a shift in the movements, there's a certain shift. So I'm inclined to say that if you start with insight and then you follow Lonergan through all the way to the end, then you're going to see a set of not just homogeneous expansions, but I think higher viewpoints as more and more things are taken into account. I'm not sure I'm right on that, but I think it might be. At any rate, there are successive higher viewpoints, and certainly anyone that is a mathematician knows that this is the case as you move from arithmetic to algebra to analytic geometry and so on and so forth. At each stage of the process, there exists a set of rules that govern operations that result in numbers. To each stage, there corresponds a symbolic image of doing arithmetic, doing algebra, doing calculus. And in each successive image, there's the potentiality of grasping by insight a higher set of rules that will govern the operations and by them elicit the numbers or symbols in the next stage. Now notice what he's saying there, where the images are. A symbolic image of doing arithmetic. Right? That provides you with the possibility of grasping by insight a higher set of rules that will take you into negative numbers, for instance. govern operations and by them elicit new numbers or symbols in the next stage. So we have, what is this image of doing arithmetic? Is it a visual image? No, it really isn't. It's not what we normally would consider a visual image of sorts. It's a, well, again, it's a concatenation of impressions. Okay, how does it come together? I guess you really have to ask a mathematician that, but it's not the normal thing that we would speak about ourselves as a visual image. Here, as elsewhere, an apt symbolism is important, and he gives the example of taking the square root of something expressed in Arabic numbers, and then if you express the same number in Roman numerals, it's a whole different kettle of fish, can of worms. An apt symbolism is important and indeed crucial, for mathematical operations are not merely the logical expansion of conceptual premises. Image and question, insight and concepts all combine. The function of the symbolism is to provide the relevant image, and the symbolism is apt in as much as its immanent patterns as well as the dynamic patterns of its manipulation run parallel to the rules and operations that have been grasped by insight and formulated in concepts. I'm told that Newton and Leibniz arrived at the calculus at the same time, and that they have different symbols for it, and that Newton's works and Leibniz's is just not as helpful. The symbolism itself is not as flexible. It's the same insight, but that Newton's gives rise to the potentiality of really doing something with it, whereas Leibniz's doesn't help that much. It's not that helpful. It's not as apt a symbolism. It helps you move on. Am I correct on that?
That might be the other way around. It's Leibniz.
Was it Leibniz and Newton?
No.
Okay, the other way around. Right. But there are two different symbolisms for the same insight, and that one of them is really helpful for generating further insights, and the other one is not. And so an apt symbolism then takes over a notable part of the solution of problems, constitutes a heuristic technique. We'll see more about that the next time. Class, offers clues, hints, suggestions, endows the pattern of a mathematical expression with the totality of its meaning, so that, and this is very important for the next couple of chapters when we get into relativity and so on, as long as the symbolic pattern is unchanged, the mathematical meaning is invariant. And finally, the apt symbolism provides the image in which may be grasped by insight the rules for the next stage. Are we still okay? All right, then, inverse insight and empirical reasoning. One of the sources of a higher viewpoint can be an inverse insight. It can be the insight that I'm going down the wrong track. This is leading nowhere. Inverse insight is different from realizing that I've been wrong. That's just correcting an insight. An inverse insight is the realization that in some fashion, there's no point to the questions that I'm asking. They're not going to lead anywhere. There's no solution to this. I'm on the wrong track. I'm asking the wrong question. The expected intelligibility is not going to be found. I gave a homily last Saturday night in which I spoke about some experiences of victimization and evil and so on, and hatred and resentment. And the question why cannot be answered. It often simply cannot be answered. Why is it? This was in the gospel was on Jesus predicting the second prediction in the gospel of Mark of his upcoming passion and death, and how in Mark's gospel particularly Jesus is portrayed as being on the receiving end of the jealousy of the religious authorities. And it's Mark 15:10 and stated quite clearly, Pilate realized that they handed him over because they were jealous of him. But the why is something that ultimately there has no answer. And that's where inverse insight is going to become important theologically and dramatically later on in the book, in the face of the whole problem of evil. There are certain questions that, as long as we pursue them along a certain line, cannot be. So they deny an expected intelligibility, not one that's already been reached. That's just correcting a mistake. That's different. But rather, to realize that the intelligibility that I'm expecting to be found is one that I'm not going for. Inverse insights generally occur, at least in science, in the context of far larger developments of understanding. I think we have very minor and limited inverse insights in everyday living that we realize that we're simply on the wrong track. We're not going to find the solution to the problems of living, you know, if we keep going along these lines. And that those inverse insights can be the source of a shift in our patterns of behavior, and even if they can apply at times at the root of conversion experiences and so on. But he gives us concrete examples in mathematics and science. Irrational numbers or surds, the square root of 2 is not and cannot be a rational fraction, but we anticipate spontaneous anyway until we've learned that it isn't. We have an anticipation that it can be. Non-countable multitudes, Newton's law that a body continues in its existing state of uniform motion in a straight line unless that state is changed by external force. Relativity's postulate that the mathematical expression of physical principles and laws is invariant even as you transform from one set of axes to another. Always there's some concomitant positive context and the dependence of inverse insight on concomitant direct insight. As I indicated a moment ago with the problem of evil, the existential significance, the social surd, and so on, which we'll talk about later on in the book. There are other places in the book where inverse insights are discussed, and where they have a far more existential and dramatic meaning than what he's talking about here. The three characteristics, there's a positive empirical object, there's a negation of intelligibility, of expected intelligibility, and that negation runs counter to the spontaneous anticipations of human intelligence. It can be, but not necessarily, is connected with ideas or principles or methods or techniques of quite exceptional significance. Any questions?
So if you look at something like Gödel's theorem and the end of Principia Mathematica, is that an inverse insight? That that's not going to work out, that a logical system to encapsulate mathematics is that a negative insight, or is that just saying they were just wrong?
What do you think? You know this stuff. What do you think? Was he negating an expected intelligibility?
He expected that all of mathematics could be reduced to logic. Russell and the early Wittgenstein, right? They thought that they could do that.
Then it is an inverse insight. That's the case.
An inverse insight. Because it wasn't like everybody thought that that could happen. So I guess for him it is. It's not.
Was it for Gödel himself? Was he seeking this and then came to the realization?
He specifically went out to prove, to find, to start with this, any set of axioms, he could develop a method for constructing a statement that could not be proved by that set of axioms. So he was specifically trying to prove
that it
inconsistency, that it had to be inconsistent.
So then what he's saying is basically that the field of the discipline itself, he would be presenting to people who were seeking the other.
His intuition was that Russell was fundamentally wrong-headed, that those guys were fundamentally wrong-headed.
And then that he meant they were on the wrong track?
Yeah, that it could not be reduced to logic. And then he went out and proved it, sort of, in a way that convinced them.
It sounds to me like there's a communal need for inverse insight that he was providing to the community of mathematicians. That's what it sounds like to me. They're expecting, these are very intelligent people, and they're expecting an intelligibility to continue to be able to be found going along a certain line, and this is part and parcel of the whole community, and he is saying, no, it's not going to work. So it's not correcting mathematical mistakes. He's calling short the pursuit.
Yeah.
And that's what an inverse insight is. It's to say, no, you're not going to get there. It's not going to happen. So I think think it's in the community itself, that's what he offered to the community of mathematicians.
If I understood you correctly, before you said that you arrived at the judgment when you realized that there are no more questions to ask. And here, in a way, you arrive at the inverse insight when you realize that it's used as the continuum asking the questions. And my question is, how do you arrive at that? How can you be so sure there are no more questions to ask?
Well, that's, it's, again, it's the, you're brought up short by the realization that there's no point to going down this road. It's not going to go anywhere.
The mathematical example is like the square root of 2.
Yeah.
You do it by proving it, presuming that the square root of 2 can be expressed as a fraction,
right,
as a rational number, and then showing that that leads to inconsistencies. And then
See, for us, because we've been over that, and we were over it fairly early on in our mathematical training, is no longer surprising to us. But
and mathematics can be pretty clear.
Yes.
But other things, like, I don't know, before you also mentioned personal relationships and all
yeah,
these
and
things.
The question of evil, for instance.
Yeah,
right?
Those are
yeah.
never clear.
I mean, I think it's a major, it can be, in a person's life, a major step, you know, to start agonizing over that question of why with regard to evil, and to realize that the only response to evil is the dialectical response of returning good. Can be a major shift. Instead of agonizing over trying to figure it out, to realize that if there were a reason for it, it wouldn't be absurd. But it is absurd. There is no reason. Ultimately, there's no reason. There's no justifying reason for certain actions, for certain attitudes. And then to realize that the only response is one that meets it. Surprise with a surprising good and love.
I guess it goes in the same realm of faith almost.
That one does. That one does, for sure. And it's one that we have to, that we don't, that doesn't necessarily sink into the habitual texture of our minds. It's one that we need constantly to be reminded of by praying on the gospel or whatever, or by Gandhi or by Martin Luther King, whoever really had it and knew how to teach it. Finally, the empirical residue. There are questions with regard to the relationship between the two. He's not consistent in the book itself. That editorial note Q tries to flatten out what really reads like an inconsistency. But at one point, somebody said to him, "Well, you said this on page such and such, and you said this a few pages later. How do you explain that?" And he said, "I didn't have a word processor." And then on another occasion, said, "It's a blunder. It got by, it escaped." But we did try to flatten it out a little bit in that editorial cue in the back of the book. But that he says at one point, inverse insight is character is regularly connected with such higher intelligibility. But now he's saying that, anyway, the empirical residue, that is always characterized by that. So the distinct but related notion of the empirical residue. Empirical residue is introduced to explore the significance of inverse insights, he says on page 50. An empirical residue consists in positive empirical data, but is denied any immanent intelligibility of its own, and it's connected with some compensating higher intelligibility of notable importance. The difference from inverse insight is that no one expects it to have an immanent intelligibility of its own, and it's characterized by, characterized, that's the important word, that's what he didn't use earlier, or at least that's how we tried to save the appearances of his writing here, and save him from an inconsistency. It's characterized by a connection with higher intelligibility in a way that inverse insight is not. So, number 22, particular places and times differ. But there's no immanent intelligibility to be grasped by direct insight into that fact. But also, they involve no modification in the intelligibility of anything else, and that's their importance that's the importance that they have for scientific generalization. Page 52. It is not mere difference of place, but something different in the places that gives rise to different observations or different experimental results in different places. Atmosphere, pressure, whatever, but not just difference of place. Similarly, it's not mere difference in time, but something different at the time that gives rise to different observations and different experimental results at different times. Were that not so, every place and every time would have its own physics, its own chemistry, its own biology. And since a science can't be worked out instantaneously in a single place, there would be no physics, no chemistry, no biology. Conversely, because the differences of particular places and particular times pertain to the empirical residue, there exists the powerful technique of scientific collaboration. A scientist in Canada can be in collaboration with a scientist in China 20 years ago. They can be working together and learning because there isn't any immanent intelligibility in time and place. There's no discrimination against any result merely because of the place or merely because of the time of its origin. Oh, well, that happened in Germany or whatever. See, there's no justification to discriminate on that basis. Even though Heidegger said that only German could do philosophy or something, he said something about the German language was the language for doing this. Again, and someone responded, it was the language for doing Heidegger's German things. Again, merely numerical difference means that every chemical element, for instance, in every compound, differs from every other kind of element or compound, and all those differences have to be explained. But every hydrogen atom differs from every other hydrogen atom, and no explanation is needed in terms of the immanent intelligibility of the hydrogen atom. There still can be something different in different places. The hydrogen atom can be part of a bomb, and another one can be part of a lake, and there's a great difference in the history of how they got to be where they are, and so on and so forth. But the immanent intelligibility of what makes it hydrogen is the same in both cases, and that's why it has the effect that it has in a bomb, and why it has the effect that it has in a lake. It's because it's hydrogen. This makes possible scientific generalization. When any set of data has been explained completely, another set of data that's similar in all respects would not call for a different explanation. And when any set of data has been explained completely, only an exhaustive tour of inspection could establish that there does not exist another set of data similar in all respects. So he's here talking about the expectations of what, in chapter 2, he will call classical empirical method. But there is also, in fact, a different kind of intelligibility grounded in the empirical residue, namely statistical intelligibility. And it combines with classical intelligibility to give a rounded scientific worldview. That's the material for the next 3 weeks, actually. So I'm just pointing ahead of where this is headed. And abstraction, what does he mean by abstraction? It doesn't mean an impoverished replica of the concrete. He means rather, to abstract is to grasp what's essential and disregard what's incidental, to see what's significant and to set aside the irrelevant, to recognize the important and the negligible as negligible, either at some given stage of development or at the term of a given development. The empirical residue will always be incidental, irrelevant, negligible, left over without explanation, even when a science reaches full development. It's what we abstract from. We abstract from the particular places and the particular times. We abstract from merely numerical differences. It's a residue. It's left. Okay. So I'm going to sit and we can discuss, and if there are questions or things that need to be discussed, that's basically the material that I've prepared.
I was thinking about the relationship between insight and logic,
yeah,
and the notion of logical contradiction. So for example, when somebody says there are no acts of understanding,
there are no acts of understanding.
Right. They would be in logical contradiction.
What he would be talking about there is not so much logical contradiction, but what he calls performative self-contradiction. If anyone were to, he'll argue in chapter 11 that if someone were to say that knowing is something other than proceeding by questions from experience to understanding to judgment, that person would have to, in order to validate their statement, would have to provide experiences which they would claim to be understanding better than the understanding that Lonergan is presenting. And Lonergan is saying, well, you might understand your experience better than, but you can't deny that you're proceeding from experience to understanding. That's what you're doing. You're providing data that you're understanding, and you're claiming to understand that data better. You're making a judgment. And that's all I'm saying, is that knowing is experiencing, understanding, and judging. So you're in performative self-contradiction by denying that, because you're doing what you deny. So that becomes a dialectical tool for him. So it's more the dialectic of concept and performance. The logical, what, I had something else that I wanted to say there, though, about how logic, and it's slipped me for a moment, in terms of logical operations. Let me come back.
I was thinking that logic is more, insight is more rudimentary than logic, because you have to have an insight into the syllogism and the relations between the various aspects of the syllogism in order to follow it. So it's, in a sense, it's more rudimentary than logic.
I did have, I had something else there that I can't remember. It's gone. Let's see if it comes back. Hansen and Robert.
I understand he gets into the book later on this. What's the connection between insight and intuition?
Well, see, intuition is a word that has many different meanings. And a lot of times the word intuition is used to mean the same thing that he means by insight. But he wants to stay away from the word intuition because it has a lot of other meanings to it that he doesn't find are helpful in terms of cognitional theory. I don't know the real by taking a good look at the already. Intuition can have that sense. Intuition in Kant is the German word for it, but it's right at the beginning of the Critique of Pure Reason. There's a whole cognitional theory that's built on intuition, confrontation with the already out there now, which he says is just a false starting point. So it depends on what people mean by intuition. But he tends to stay away from the word because it can mean so many different things.
You have to have data. You have to have an experience.
Yeah.
You're into a real living situation.
Yeah.
And you have an intuition. Somehow there's a process there.
Yeah. Now he would call it,
that's insight.
That's insight.
Yeah.
It's bringing it together.
Yeah.
So we talk about our following our instincts too.
That's right.
But
that's
I mean,
right.
Actually,
yeah.
You're following clues,
yeah,
and leads, and so on and so forth when you're doing it, you know.
Earlier on, you were talking about that. To me, relates to learning styles. How we come to a particular topic. In my family, I have a person who's very logical,
yeah,
his sister is an intuitive type person, and they clash. You know, they come to it in different ways. They don't communicate very well.
No, and they won't, they're not going to, as long as they stay just like that.
That's
but
right.
But actually, the gifts of one and the gifts of another are both needed in cognitional process.
Yeah.
We have to be able to be logical, you know, because the every testing of an insight involves logical operations.
Yeah.
It does. Every testing of a hypothesis, there's that formulation.
Yeah.
That's there. We don't always put it that way, but logic is at work at that point when you're testing. And that holds for both of them, for both the one who's logical and for the other. If they've got an insight and they're testing it, logic is going to be a player. So one can teach the other. But on the other hand, the one who's intuitive, that is to say, who leaps to insight, that insight is a leap. It's going beyond anything that you can put your fingers on or put into any kind of set of propositions where one follows from another in some kind of deductive story.
Thank you.
Just on what John was saying, in pointing out the performative contradiction, that's really a logical statement, isn't it?
It is a logical statement.
You say this is the case, but if you think it through,
it's a retortion,
you're making a contradiction.
Which is a logical statement. And it can anger people, you know, because they can't get out of it logically, and they still don't want to admit what those kinds of things can do that. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that this one necessarily does, although I think it has angered some people. Part of it is you're caught. But yeah, there is a logic to the retortion argument. Aristotle said he had the same thing. What do you do with the skeptic? Get him to talk. You know, once he's talking, he's making judgments. You've caught him in a performative self-contradiction. Because if he says a sentence and means it, then he's not a skeptic. Because he's making a claim. Once you make a claim, you're no longer a universal skeptic.
Mm-hmm. How does deduction come into play with insight? In terms of logic, deductive methods?
Yeah, okay. Well, I gave you the one instance where it's very clear, namely the testing of an insight in order to determine whether it's true or not. That's a logical deduction. If A, then B, but B, therefore possibly A. Or you can go the other way, if A then B, but A then B. In a very early paper that was paid attention to, by the way, by some mathematical logicians, it was reviewed. In the Journal of Symbolic Logic, it does receive acknowledgement. A paper that he wrote in 1943 called The Form of Inference. He basically reduces, argues that all syllogistic reasoning can be reduced to the if A, then B, but A, therefore B, and some rearrangements, various arrangements of all of that. He takes all of the syllogistic forms that are offered in Aristotle's logic and he casts them all into that. It's in the process of experiencing, understanding, judging. Logic doesn't only come in where I indicated it. It's also sometimes we have to think in order to move to insight, and that thinking involves logical operations because we catch ourselves in inconsistencies and so on, and then correct ourselves. The self-correcting process of learning, part of that is not simply new insights. Part of it is also using logical operations in order to correct, to catch our inconsistencies and so on. The point of it is that insight and judgment are far more important than logical procedure, following the logical rules and so on.
I was just wondering if you could go back over empirical residue.
Yeah. Can I make one more statement in response to Bernard? That's why he says we use the rules in order to arrive at insight, But we don't arrive at insight because we followed the rules. There's a difference there. The rules help you get there, but they're not the reason that, that you have arrived at. The empirical residue.
Empirical residue. So this is Aristotle's prime matter.
It will play out into that eventually. Yes. Good.
So I
prime potency is Lonergan's term.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering. So can we? It's not a what. So in terms of a description, can we say? Can I call it an irreducible difference of fact? That, in the sense that, because it's fact, there's no imminent intelligibility there, but it's the irreducible difference that seems to be significant.
The irreducible difference is correct. Fact is another loaded word.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because if what is a fact? Okay.
Right.
A fact is something that you know in judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now when you make a statement about empirical residue, then that statement is, you're claiming that statement is factual. But as merely empirical, you're not yet at factual. And merely empirical means it's experienced, but you're not trying to find a what to it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It's left over in your experience. So I would say more like it's a merely empirical. What was your other difference?
I said irreducible.
Irreducible empirical difference.
Yeah. Okay. No empirical residue on God.
I've always been confused by the notion of empirical residue because I get the sense that residue is something that's left over.
Well, there's a sense in which this is.
It seems to me
it's
that
left, it's just there. Okay.
It seems to me like it's a surplus rather than a leftover.
And why do you say that? Because you know what's coming in the book, or is it? Would you? I mean, it's a surplus
because
it gives rise to the possibility of statistical intelligibility, which we're start to see next week. There's a way in which it functions, and it's not just there.
When I hear the word empirical, I think I should be able to see this residue. Revealing my lack of intellectual conversion here.
No, it's particular places, particular times, merely numerical difference, we experience those things. At the prime first level of consciousness. But we don't find any kind of what next week we'll see to be a classical form of intelligibility in that. As a matter of fact, that there is significance to it that is broader than he's been able to pinpoint so far. There still will be something that's left over, namely non-systematic divergence from probabilities. We'll see that next week. Chance. These things all fit, but I don't want to anticipate all of that. I'm not ready to anticipate it. I haven't prepared that. Yes, Robert.
This sense of empirical residue that physics is the same everywhere. So if it seems that place does make a difference, then that suggests that the science is not yet at a proper level of generalization. If I think that water boils at 100 degrees centigrade and I go to the top of a mountain, find it, it means I haven't reached a general enough understanding of heat and of
yeah, I think so. If I'm understanding you correctly, I would say that's right. But
with Newton and Einstein, that if I find that, in fact, something changes because I'm on a spaceship that's going close to the speed of light, then that begins to suggest that Newton's stuff isn't general enough.
Yeah.
It isn't abstract enough.
That's right.
So it works the other way, too, if there's not enough if it seems to be empirical residue makes a difference, then it means further
questions. See, it's also, this is also important for the notion of development in science, that you had to have Newton before you could have Einstein. But it's not a matter of just that they're in, that there's a different intelligibility because at one particular time from another, but something different in the time. That Einstein's time is different because Newton went before him, and so there's something different at Einstein's time so that he could do what he did. So it's not a mere difference in time. There's something different in the science at his time because of everything that went before it. And that's why he could do what he did. Not because it's a different time, but because there's something different in the time. The history is different. Does that make sense?
So I guess maybe I'm still confused, I guess, between the difference between empirical residue and maybe what is just chalked up as experimental error. Because in Einstein's time, I mean, there were all of these observations that had been around for a long time that just didn't fit into the model, but there was nothing better. And they just sort of sat there, like perturbations in the orbit of Mars that didn't fit into the three-body problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, I can explain this.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But that's not... And other things in electromagnetic fields, right, that were anomalies, I guess, based on whatever the theory was at the time, didn't quite fit, couldn't really be chalked up to experimental error, but they just said, for now, okay, we just don't know how to explain it,
okay.
We'll call it experimental error.
Okay.
So it goes from being experimental error to actually being a negative insight, because it tells you that, an inverse insight, because it tells you that whole theory was wrong.
Well, okay. What I was hearing before your last sentence was was not empirical residue, but rather something where there was an intelligibility that was expected, but they just didn't know it yet. So that's not the empirical way. Nobody expects that there's going to be any explanation to a particular place at a particular time or to merely the radical difference. It doesn't make any difference. Whereas,
But in the example, you were saying, well, what's different in history? So what was different in the history was an accumulation of a lot of these unexplained things that for many years people would just say, well, that's experimental error. We can't deal with it. We don't know what it is. Probably, just like the questions you're saying. Well, you figure, well, you measure something from the bottom of the mountain to the top of the mountain. Before they knew that, I mean, it's experimental error because you can't control all the circumstances, whatever. So it's stuff that everybody just threw away as being unimportant, unintelligible, statistical variation in things that are not controlled in the model.
They didn't. To correct me if I'm wrong on this, but they didn't say that it had no scientific significance. They were saying that we don't know what the scientific significance of it is yet. Am I right? Is that what you mean? And that's not what he means by empirical residue.
Okay, so what he means by empirical residue is stuff that we all agree.
That means like
the
fact
that
hydrogen,
this hydrogen atom or that hydrogen atom.
It's the same intelligence.
It has to be
it doesn't make any difference that this is one and that's another.
Yeah.
It's the same. The intelligibility in terms of the periodic table is going to be exactly the same. That's what it means. And there's no difference because it's here or there. And that's all. And we don't expect that there will be. But with the data that you're talking about, it's that they didn't know yet, and they wanted to. Now, they may have been on the wrong track, and if they got to the point where they realized that, then there's an inverse insight to it.
But for many years, it's about attention. I mean, for many years, they just ignored it. I mean, they knew that when they did the measurements, whenever you do anything,
but
in
don't
physical
you,
science,
don't
work.
You, don't we all, if we've reached an impasse, after a while, we just say, I got to go on. I got to move on.
Yeah.
And so I'm just going to ignore some things, but not because there's no intelligibility there, but because I haven't found it yet, but I can't spend the rest of my life on that. So I got to go on. And so we all do that in one way or form or another. And you're saying here this is a whole field of science that was doing that for a while. But it wasn't that they were saying that it's never going to be understood. It's just that we don't know yet what it is. I think. Right?
I think it's
more complicated.
I think that they just thought it's just not important. It just wasn't for many years. I mean, this goes back to the way Kuhn looks at it. It's not important. We don't care about it. And then all of a sudden it becomes critical.
Then,
in history.
I got you. But that would not be the same as empirical residue.
No, honestly. Okay.
All right. Chapter 2 next week. The classical.
Yeah,